Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Right, hello, welcome to the Mouth of Manliness. This is another lockdown episode. We are via Zoom with a very wonderful guest, artist Gary Mansfield, who I'm quite pleased to say has become a bit of a mate to me.
Yeah.
It's really nice. Like, we've chatted a lot, haven't we? I did your podcast the other day, but generally we've had a few chats on here and we've become pretty good mates. I like it.
Yeah, we got to sort of experiment with Zoom, didn't we, between us?
Yeah, Gary kind of taught me how to do kind of video interviews, and now I'm just using it to death.
I really only had about five or ten minutes more experience than you.
I know. Well, we worked it out together, didn't we, mate? It was really cool. So Gary has an art podcast called The Ministry of Art, and he has interviewed me, which is was quite humbling, really. But he's actually interviewed like masses of artists. How many podcasts have you had out?
It's up to 69 now. I was doing it weekly, then I shortened it to every 14 days, just because it was getting a bit too much to just to bring one out while I'm working and stuff, you know, every week.
Yeah. So you've had some big names, though, haven't you? You've had like Turner Prize winners.
Yeah, I've done all right. I've done okay.
Done amazing. But
it was handy because I knew him before I'd done the podcast anyway.
Right, so for those who don't know, Gary does these really fantastic drawings, artwork, and you might have seen them. He'll make like a padlock, and it'll be made up of like hundreds and hundreds of little tallies, you know, like four lines with a line through it. And they're really quite fascinating, I think. You can look at them for ages, and sometimes you have like writing around them, don't you? A little bit of writing in there. There's just a lot to take in. And you've done really well, haven't you?
They've done them right. They was they're ticking all the boxes at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So it's amazing. You've done amazingly well. But what's more interesting, and partly the reason for kind of why I wanted to get you on, really, apart from the fact that you're a really good guy,
There is that.
But like your journey to become an artist is quite a strange, is quite a different type.
It's not many like me out there, that's for sure.
No, but as you were saying, like someone said, art needs more voices like yours.
Yeah, I agree.
I did a podcast with Rich Wilson the other day.
Oh, nice.
He said, like mental health needs more voices like ours, like normal voices, people like working class, normal kind of people. Well, I wouldn't put myself in a normal bracket, but you know what I mean. So, tell me a little bit about, shall we start then with how you came to discover art.
Right, well, I'll have to go back a couple of years before. I grew up in Dagenham in Essex, working class family, single parent family. I always enjoyed getting into trouble a bit more than most. I like the thrill of being chased and told off, and you know, that just being a fucking tearaway, really. But that stayed with me throughout my life. Then I got into the fake clothing when the casuals came out in the sort of mid-80s. And I worked my way up from being a sort of street vendor to then supplying the street vendors and then supplying the ones who supplied the street vendors. So I was working my way up the ladder. And I was, at the same time, I had a security company. We had a lot of nightclubs where we was doing doorman, we was doing everything that went off the back of that, bodyguarding, debt collecting, all that sort of shit that involved, you know, brawn rather than brains.
I think your headphones are feeding back.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's better.
I've only got one in.
That's probably
Is that better? Fine.
Yeah. Sorry, everyone.
Sorry. Yeah, so it's just, do you want me to redo that bit?
No, I don't cut anything out.
Oh, okay, sorry, fair enough. Yeah, so it come to a point where I just met this new guy who was supplying me. And he was from Essex. And I've been getting my clothing off of him for about 4, 5, 6 months. And I told him that I was going up to Liverpool to visit some friends. He asked if I could drop some of the labels off to his guys in Birmingham on my way up there, who were sort of stitching them into the clothing. So I agreed. He was giving me a few quid to go up there. That'll pay for my weekend away. So I picked him up, picked these bags up from a lorry park in Essex. To take him up to Birmingham. And as I put him in my car, I'm pulling out, all of a sudden, police come from everywhere, armed police, they put my window through, they dragged me out of the car.
Oh, really? What, straight away?
Yeah, as soon as I thought it was a car chase because I saw it in my rearview mirror as I was reversing out, and I thought it was a police van chasing a police car.
Yeah.
Then it's come into the lorry park. It's come into the lorry park. I'm reversing out. A woman's jumped out, come running towards me. I thought she was the one getting chased, and I thought she was going to like try and hijack my car or something. But just as she got to my car door, that's when my back window went through. The doors, it was strange because all this happened in like 2 or 3 seconds, but it felt like I was watching a movie, you know. It felt like it was about a 10-minute thing. Before she even got to me, my door flew open. And I was getting dragged out, and I could still see her coming towards me, but it turned out to be like another copper. And they've stood me up, and I've put my hands in the air, and one of them's kicked my left foot away, and I've gone down and hit my chin on the roof of the car. And I've turned around to give him a clamp, and there was another one there with a machine gun pointing the gun at me. He's going, go on, go on. And I was like, fuck, they're trying to kill me, you know, trying to get me.
Well, like there was any need for all of that.
I know, but they was all fired up, you know.
Yeah.
So even they was being that OTT, even this woman who turned out to be a customs officer, she's jumped in front was a bit of an exaggeration. She sort of stopped the cops. She's going to them, calm down, he's complying, or something like that. Oh, because one of them gave me a dig up the ribs with a truncheon as well, just before. But as I was going down, he's giving me a dig in the ribs. But anyway, I've got arrested. Turns out it wasn't clothing labels in there. It was heroin. And it weren't a little bit of heroin. It was £4.2 million worth. So 50 kilos of heroin, yeah. And the worst thing is, I had fuck all to do with drugs. But all the time I was a criminal.
Yeah.
Never, I'd worked in the club since the rave started. Never took a pill, never sold a pill. I just weren't into drugs, you know. Never had a line of gear. Tried a joint once or twice, weren't my thing. Now I'm lumbered with fucking 50 kilos of heroin, you know.
So you got proper stitched up, and they were probably waiting for you.
Yeah, yeah. It turns out they was looking at this. The guy I was getting it off, this guy Sid, they knew that he was receiving it because it turned out it turned up just before I got there. Yeah. So they knew it was going to him, but they didn't know it where it was going after that. You know, that's what we found out in court and through the paperwork we received and that. They was just waiting, and they didn't know who was bringing it to this lorry park and who was picking it up. So they was just waiting for someone to get drugs out of, or big bags out of one car and put them in another, you know. And it just so happens that it was me they saw. Yeah, found out down the police station that it was drugs, went off me nut a bit, you know. And the guy who sort of, who was in between me and this Sid, the one who sort of set me up, he turned up in the police station just when I found out what it was. And this was a strange old feeling because I'd gone. When they said it was heroin, I'm like, proper freaked.
Yeah.
And as I was freaking, and the coppers were just trying to calm me down. It was just as they took my cuffs off in the custody suite at the Nick. And I've heard the chains and the doors opening, and they've brought the fella in who was in between me and this Sid, like the one who's got me involved with this fella. And I went, fucking heroin, and I was gone running over towards him. And I mentioned this a few times. It was like, as I'm running towards him to batter the life out of him, you know,
yeah.
I felt this resistance. It was like, you know when you're in a swimming pool when you was a kid and you're running around and you can't run as fast as you'd like to? That's what I was feeling, this resistance. But the resistance turned out to be a cop around my neck, one around my waist, and I'm fucking dragging one along with my right or left foot. He was just holding on to one ankle trying to grab the other, you know?
So you kind of lost that consciousness that they were there.
Gone completely.
So
that red mist, which I'd only had once or twice in my life,
right.
When you just become oblivious to your surroundings and you're just like a fucking Jack Russell on a rat, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you said earlier that it was just your mum. So do you think that had any bearing on kind of how things played out?
Well, I don't know. I've always thought possibly it will. But my brother wasn't like me. My brother's about 3 or 4 years younger than me. And he's not like me at all. So that can't be the factor.
Well, I suppose we all respond differently to things. I tell you, the reason I ask is it's all that kind of thing is always thrown around. You know, like, well, missing dads, what do you expect? You know, young gang members because their dads aren't around. And like, and I never really like the way it's just thrown around as like that's accepted as fact.
Yeah, and as if it's hereditary as well. Because my dad was a criminal. I was a criminal, and he never lived with me. And I thought maybe it's in the fucking blood. So when I had kids, and by this point mindset had changed from being a criminal to being an artist and being a non-criminal.
Yeah,
I didn't want anything of my background to be in his blood, if you like. So I was so stern on him as he was growing up, overly stern. Didn't want him doing anything like I used to do, you know, in case I was trying to figure out what it was that made me turn out like I did. So I just stopped him doing anything at all that I did when I was a kid, in case that was the key or the trigger that turned me, you know?
Yeah, like I think like that's how you solve the problem, isn't it? You know, like
it's like this virus. You stay in, you stop any contact to break the chain.
Yeah, it's interesting. So did you, like when you were growing up, was it pretty tough?
It was in the 80s and the, you know, late 70s, when it was the mods and the skinheads, there was a lot of racism about, there was a lot of, you know, it was one of them where you'd get fucking beaten up just by looking different from someone else, you know?
Yeah, I think I kind of started to kind of come of age a little bit after that. I do remember that stuff. But
I think I've got a couple of years on you anyway.
Yeah, I'm 44.
Oh, see, I'm 51.
Are you? Are you? Mm.
Fat face, it pulls all the wrinkles out. Exactly. If I lose a lot of weight, I'll end up looking 60.
You never want to be skinny when you get older. Those older. So when what happened then? So you found out it was heroin, which must have just scared the living shit out of you. After the anger, it's like, oh fuck, I'm fucked.
Yeah, I knew that with the amount of drugs that I had, I was likely to get about 18 years if I was found guilty. Now, I know it sounds obvious, you go, well, fucking hell, he's got £4.2 million worth of drugs in his car. Yeah. Of course he's guilty. But I was going on the thing that I had no idea what it was.
Yeah.
And if I could, as much as I don't have to prove that, I had to prove that because it looks so fucking dodgy. Mm. Because in the eyes of the law, I didn't know what it was. I shouldn't have been found guilty. But I'm in the position, it's this big chain of people and I've got a bad criminal record anyway. The police have been on me, for years. You fucking take your chance.
Yeah, I suppose they'd just say it's possession, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
So you just get fucked with possession because you are in possession of it to all intents and purposes, but only for like a moment.
Yeah, but it's the moments
that... So your mitigation, like, they didn't have any, they didn't really have an angle. Did you plead not guilty, didn't you?
Oh, of course, yeah. I just told them exactly what... And normally, I would just make up anything at court. Or just go, no comment, I went no comment in my interview, but when I went to court, I just told them the fucking truth. And I thought, well, if I tell them I didn't give names or anything like that, but I told them exactly my side of the story. They asked who I was going to visit. I said, friends. They said, what friends? I said, friends. I weren't going to give, fucking my friends were proper at it up in Liverpool, And it came to a point when the prosecution did say to me, is Sid in this room? And he had been arrested.
Oh, really?
And he was in front of me. And the thing is, I used to work with some really big names before I got arrested, like villains, And they was about as sort of big as you can get without throwing any names about.
Yeah.
And when I spoke to them, they was all going... When you get in the dock, just point and go, yeah, that's him. That's the fella who stitched me up. Because they've put me in this position unwittingly, So even these fucking well-known gangsters were going, you're entitled to, or he should be standing up and going, it weren't him. It was me, taking the dairy off me. But he didn't. And when they were saying to me, just fucking stand up and point him, I was going, I can't, it ain't in me. And I was living by them soppy fucking unwritten rules, that's the one thing you don't do. And they was going like, well, if anyone comes and, pulls you, just point them in our direction. Tell them that, we're fucking... And I was going, I can't, it's not me. And when they said he's sitting in the room, and I've looked up, and I looked over to him, and he's just put his head down, and I went, no. And at that point, when I said no, I knew I'd fucked myself. I knew I was gone.
Yeah.
But I felt proud for that moment that I'd done what I regarded at that point in my life as the right thing. Yeah. I stood up, I was counted, done what I thought was right, and suffered consequences. But as soon as I said no, he's looked up, looked over at his family, and went, yes, with a big grin on his face, and done one of them little fucking fist pumps. And it was at that point when I looked at him and I just thought, you cunt. Fucking sailed myself down the river and you can't even fucking acknowledge me and give me a nod, you know what I mean? And that was at the point, that was the start of me wanting to get out of that fucking life because there were so many monkey cunts like him.
Yeah.
In that game. Everyone goes, oh yeah, we'll look after our own. Yeah. And that's all bollocks, you know what I mean? There's a few of them, but they're at the bottom of the ladder. The ones at the top of the ladder, they are fucking no good. They're like him. They're all fucking wrong-uns.
I say that to people all the time, like at work, and they're like, no, but my mates, my mates. I'm like, Yeah, mates now. But if they're really your mates, they wouldn't want you to get into shit. And they're like, yeah, you don't understand. I'm like, I understand more than you know.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. So then what did you get then?
Well, I ended up getting a 14.
Right.
And as I say, I've got it in my head that I'd be getting out of jail when I'm 35.
Yeah.
Because I know you have to do half the sentence.
Yeah.
So when I got told I was getting a 14, in my head, although it was a couple of weeks after I'd been sentenced, yeah, to when I was found guilty to when I was sentenced, and in that fortnight, I could feel myself slipping away mentally because of what's happened, the treachery, and you know, it's them bad things when you've been had over, yeah, that really affect you, and I could feel them. And I don't know how, I couldn't explain how I went the other way or stopped myself from doing it, but there was like a little something, like a little switch inside, for instance, I must have just sort of pressed to stop getting myself down. And then I just started reevaluating and just going, right, I'm going to be doing a 9. That's it. When I got to court, he said 14. So I'd already just done 2 years. I'd had 2 years knocked off my mental sentence, you know, if you know what I mean.
2 years on remand?
No, what I meant was I've done a year on remand, but because mentally I'd put myself as getting an 18 and doing 9, yeah, when he said I've got 14, which meant I only had to do 7, okay, mentally I've just done 2 years in my, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now I'm getting out when I'm 33.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say I was happy, but people think I was fucking a bit odd when I say this, but I genuinely looked over to the judge and give him a nod as if to go, thank you, because the absolute minimum I could have got was 14 years. So he gave me the absolute minimum, which to me sounds like he fucking believed me. Do you know what I mean?
I've been in court so many times, and you kind of get the sense that the judge is acknowledging the situation.
Yeah, well, the judges have a sliding scale. They had, for my category, they had 14 to life. That was, you know, that was it. And anything in between those. And he gave me 14.
Yeah.
And as I say, mentally, I'd prepared for 18. And I've done, you know, he'd given me that.
The other guy doing the fist bump probably helped as well, because it then just made him look really fucking guilty.
Yeah.
Shit, so I was thinking, like, by the time you actually then went into jail, like, you'd already been in for a year on remand.
Yeah.
Like, remand has got to be the worst, though, surely. It's
the easiest bit of bird. Easiest bit of jail time, because you've got so much more freedom. Once you get convicted, you've got a different mindset anyway, because you've got that bit of hope when you're on remand, 50-50, am I going to get away with it, am I not? As soon as you've been sentenced, you've got a sort of, it's as if a dial goes off in your head, because you have a completely different mindset, you know. Now I'm going, right, I've got 7 years or another 6 years left. But on the flip side to that, I was like, when you look forward to 6 years,
yeah,
that another fucking long way away. Yeah. And at that point, I was angry with them, with the court system for not believing me. I was angry with fucking everyone. So, and again, I say this to a lot of people, I really wasn't the person that you're speaking to today. I was a completely different person, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me, I just had a phone. Completely different person. So I went a bit the other way, you know, I went a bit more violent, and I was a bit of an arse when I got nicked. I went even more of an arse for about, I don't know, 4 months or something, 4, 5, 6 months.
I've got a mate who did quite a long stretch, and he did the same. It kind of got stitched up, and then he did pretty much the same. He went for a really long period. I think he got like 6 years, and he did at least half of it was hard time, because he was just so angry.
I think a lot of it, Nick, as well, is like self-preservation, you know?
Yeah.
Because you go, right, because you're feeling so fucking weak, or me personally, when I look back, I can't think my mindset at the time, because I was in a, you know, a wrong place.
Yeah.
But when I look back at it, I think it was like a self-preservation. I was feeling so weak, vulnerable, and a victim, really, because I'd been fucking head over, mugged off, you know, completely. So I was feeling a bit of a lesser man. So I was trying to prove to myself and others around me, I ain't just been mugged off. You know, that's, you know, trying to sort of do it that way, you know.
So did you have kids and that and miss at the time?
No.
Okay. So that's a bit...
Yeah, it's good.
A bit easier. How old were you when you went in on the...
26.
Right.
And the thing is, I said it when I was away at the time. I had such a fucking good life. If you look at it, I mean, some people say it was fucking crazy, but I was in the rave scene when it started. I fucking loved it. As I say, I never took pills and all that, but I loved that scene. I loved the people. Yeah. I was around the... like the lap dancing and all that, when that kicked off, and we was doing that, like, you know, we was doing stuff with the girls, taking them around. It was just a fucking real fun time, you know. I was having it with some celebrities at the time who were sort of, you know, like the Freddie Starr and, you know, them sort of people at the time. Yeah. They were my mates. We was going away with them, having just, it was just a real fucking good point of my life.
Yeah.
Everything was going really good. I was living an exciting life, you know, with getting into lots of tear-ups. I was involved in the people, like the gangsters that you read about in books, you know, they were my mates. It was all just it was like living in a fucking film, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it was just taken away. It was hard. It was hard. But then it just got adjusted. Because normally when you go into a prison, you have to sort of prove yourself, you know, when you walk in, you have people looking down, just like you see in the films, you know, people looking down off the other landings, looking at you. But when I went into Chelmsford, Nick, and Chelmsford, not much goes on in Essex really, as such, on a day-to-day basis. When I got nicked, and it got to the prison before I got there, that this bloke, being me, when the police pointed a gun at me and hit me with a truncheon, I turned around and attacked the copper with the gun, which didn't happen, but I weren't going to fucking say that he didn't. I was going to run with it. So when we walked into the jail, or, you know, when I walked in and everyone's looking down at us, normally when people stare at you and sort of try and half intimidate you, people weren't even looking at me in the eye, you know. They were like...
Safe.
Hmm?
So you were safe, like people.
Yeah. Oh yeah, as soon as I walked in.
Right with him.
Yeah, well, it turns out I knew a few, but every jail I went to, I knew a few people in there anyway, you know. So it's handy.
So was there, I guess what I'm trying to get to is that I know there was the point when you kind of, when you started doing artwork, and I just wonder if there was any kind of points prior to that where you were like, you know, those moments when you like think like you're really down and then you make sense of things or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say a specific point, but I know this is the specific moment in time, you know, that sort of general area was when I got nicked. I was just thinking then, you know, that these people who are higher up the ladder, a lot of them I've seen to be untrustworthy, you know. And I thought, I don't want to be a part of them. When I got to the jail, and you've got like a lot of prisoners, most of them are just all right people. You know, you'd get on with my, or, you know, you work in that field. Most of them are all right people.
Yeah.
A lot of them are fucking nasty, horrible shitbags. And when I was around then, and people who I put myself on a similar rung to, I was looking at them, and they were, I just didn't like the way they were acting. And I saw that they were acting rather than them being themselves.
Yeah.
And then in my head, I'd be going, oh, fucking, I can't have it with these people. And they're me, you know? And then I was thinking, that what I don't like about that person, I did that. When I hear someone, or when I say something in a conversation to someone, and I go like, this is one I do remember. When I go, oh, yeah, it's one of your own. And then I cringe because I fucking hate that. That one of your own, you know, that sort of gangstery bollocks.
Yeah.
And then I'd catch myself saying things, and it was then I started to realise there was things about me I didn't like. And it wasn't until I got into the art class, and just by chance, I'd never into art. The tutor there was really funny. He was a really funny, he was like Basil Fawlty. He was just constantly having a go at people. I always explained him as a camp Camp Basil Fawlty.
Yeah.
He was just really fun, and he was great to be around. And he'd give me a drawing exercise. I've done it. It looked like what I was meant to draw. He gave me another one. I've done it. It looked like it was meant to do, you know? And I thought, fucking hell, there is a little something in me that's here.
Yeah.
And then he gave me some art books, started reading them, and I was enjoying them. All of a sudden, it grew and grew. And someone gave me the Sensations catalogue, which was on at the time, which is one where Damien Hirst cut the cow in half and, you know, the Myra Hindley. He's given me that. I've looked through it. Thought it was a load of shit. I thought, you know, anyone can do that type of art, you know. But in amongst it was a colander that was upside down, just like a normal vegetable colander with all nuts and bolts in the holes. And I was going, like, how's this a fucking artwork? You know, it's a trip down B&Q and, you know, a tenner spent, you know. And he said, well, I have a read of it. And it was, he let me take the catalogue back to my cell overnight. And I was looking, and I looked at this particular one. And I turned it up, turned it upside down. I turned it over because it was on like this little postcard. And it was an artist called Mona Hatoum. And she was either Palestinian living in Lebanon or Lebanese living in Palestine, one of the two. She'd come to the UK to study. There was a regime change at home. She was no longer allowed back. And this upside down colander acted as a barrier over her homeland. The nuts and bolts were blocked entrances and exits, you know, so there was no way in getting back. So I don't know whether it was just my environment where I was. It's resonated with me, you know, and I've gone like, how can she explain all of that in just a trip down to B&Q with a bag of nuts and bolts and a colander? And then that sort of made me look at that. That's called conceptual art. Because
you go, conceptual art.
Yeah, because they're talking about the concept rather than what it's made of. And that just made me realise, well, of course, it's not. It's a, how I've always explained it, that conceptual art is just a 3D representation of an idea. And that's exactly what it was. And then that made me look at all this other artwork in different eyes and give it a bit of time rather than just look at something. Like when you look at a person, you go, oh, I don't like the look of him.
Yeah.
They could be the nicest person ever, you know. It was that sort of thing.
You might have thinking about things a little bit, didn't it? You know, like, you know, like so many people go like fucking Warhol, what is a fucking, it's Campbell's soup can. And you're like,
exactly.
More to it than that, and like, and if you just want to see it like that, that's fine. But yeah, that moment when you go from what I like the old shit to fucking hell,
it's just become the most powerful bit of work I've ever seen, you know.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to know more about it,
right.
So went up into the prison library the next day, and they only had stuff about French masters, you know, and Italian masters.
Yeah.
They didn't have anything about relevant stuff, you know. It's definitely not like this. It was very cutting edge. So in the back of the catalogue, it had all the artists' names and the galleries that represented them. So I'd been doing quite a lot of drawings at this time, like cartoon stuff, for phone cards or for stamps or for tobacco, you know, for to other cons. So I said to a few people, rather than pay me a phone card or tobacco, give me some stamps. So I wrote a letter to 32 of these artists. And I figured, it was like, it sounds a bit sexist, but it's how I used to be at the end of a nightclub in the like 90s. You'd go and talk to 20, 30 different girls in the hope that, one of them might... Fishing with a net rather than a rod.
I dig that. Yeah.
So that's what I thought. I thought, write to all of them in the hope that I might get one reply.
I just don't want to miss something that you said earlier about, like, when you looked at other people, you saw them doing things that you do and you didn't like. Like, that's quite an amazing thing, Gary, I think. You know, so many people go for their whole lives without really being self-aware.
Yeah.
And that's quite an amazing thing to kind of come to that point. Because most people don't, like, they may decide to give up that life, but it's not normally on those kind of grounds. It's like, I've just fucking had enough, getting nicked. But to say, like, oh, I see something in you, and now I've got fucking intelligence enough to think, look at myself.
Yeah.
That impresses me, shit like that.
I mean, there was, and no, that's quite right, but there was a, you know, that didn't just come like that. That was a, you know, a progressive route that I took to get there. And it'd be like, on that same sort of thing, it would be where, like in the jail I was in, there was violence, so much stabbings, and it was awful. You know, they're constantly running around with a defibrillator.
Yeah.
But like, you'd see someone sharpening a blade, or someone would go like, look, could you just hold this blade for me until it's time to kick off, and then put it over there, and I'll, you know, because I'm going to go and fucking stab someone. And you would, it's just part, it sounds crazy, but it's just, you don't know the person, but you're helping them out because you just help each other out. Mm. But you always just, like, on one of the things, on that same sort of thing we was talking about, one point I went, what are we doing that for? He said he owes me a phone card, like a £4 phone card. I went, so you're going to open him up over a £4 phone card? And he went, well, yeah, because there is more, you know, it is about the fucking front. And,
but still.
And I went, and because I was pretty flush in there, you know, with phone cards and tobacco, and so, I went, you know, take a fucking £4 phone card. Hang up, leave him. Don't open him up. You know, he was like a junkie who couldn't pay.
Yeah.
You know, and he's going to get opened up over a £4, stabbed over a £4 phone card.
Yeah.
I just took a phone card. I said, yeah, I have a £4 phone card. I pay his debt for him. You know, that sort of thing. Because in there, you justify everything. Someone's going to get severely hurt over something stupid, and you just go, yeah, he fucking deserves it.
It's so small, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, everything just gets blown up. It's like now, you know, everyone's indoors, so things just get blown up. Where on a normal day or in a normal place, you'd be like, well, it don't matter.
But then I liked the fact, I like what I got from it, and I don't know what it was, but I like the feeling I got from it about bucking the trend, not being one of them. You know, I don't know whether mentally I might have thought I was better than them. I don't know what it was, but whatever it was a feeling that I liked.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go down that route. And because I had quite a reputation in there anyway as being, you know, a fighter and that sort of thing, not a lot of people would question me. And then other people would come out, and getting onto mental health, when I started noticing when it was that people, because depression's fucking rife in there.
Yeah.
So is self-harm, suicide, or taking your own life rather. But you get to know when someone's starting to go down that path, you know. And you do get in there, the other cons do rally around to try to bring them back out of that dark place until it gets to a point, I don't know whether it's inside all of us, but when you know that person's gone a bit too far for you to help, and it doesn't get discussed, but you sort of pull away from the person. Because it sort of becomes as if you're catching it, you know, sort of becomes a bit too much for you to handle, possibly. Yeah. And everyone does back off at the same point. And then, as I say, you see people setting themselves on fire in there, cutting themselves or doing whatever.
Yeah.
And I did just think it was so fucking easy not to get to that point, you know, or to get the person just before. And I did realise that it was fucking talking, like, you know, like you do, and that it's become an open thing now, or a more open rather.
Yeah.
Whereas going back into like the mid to late 90s, especially in a prison, no one talks about fucking feelings or being weak because people fucking pounce on
it. Yeah.
But because I was in that position where people wouldn't pounce on me, I started fucking using it. So if I saw someone I thought was on that slippery slope, and I knew that just talking to someone helps, I'd realise that. Yeah. Because I've always been quite open myself, but I was very picky on who I spoke to, you know.
Yeah.
But I'd go up to them and I'd say, even if I didn't know them that well, I'd go up to them and I'd go, can I just borrow you for a minute? And like, you know, they thought I was going to get a good hiding in myself. And on the way there, I'd go, like, look, even if I didn't know them that well, I'd say, like, I've seen you about, I know that you're a fucking nice bloke. I just want to talk to you a minute. So I'd go in there and they'd be all worried because they think they're going to get, you know, clumped or whatever. And I'd say, listen, do you mind if I have a chat? Don't repeat it to anyone. I've just been dumped by the other half. And I don't really know what to do. And then like, oh, fuck.
And well, then you said that.
Yeah, I just like make up a story, you know.
Wow.
So to make them see this big, yeah, strong bloke and go, fucking hell, he's vulnerable. That was my thinking. But it was proven to work.
You're genius.
So then I'd go like, oh, my fucking other half dumped me and I don't know what to do. I've been with her for, I don't know, a year, like pen pal type bird, you know. And it's fucking really good. What do you reckon I should do? Like, she's been seeing someone else or, you know, something like that. And then all of a sudden it's giving them a bit of, because most of the time with depression, I found, and this is through no, you know, I've not read this anywhere, but I always realise that it's where you lose a bit of your own self-worth.
Yeah.
So I'm, in my head, I was like trying to give them a bit of that. You know, although it was fake, I was trying to give them a bit. And then they'd go, well, no, I don't think you should do that, for instance. You know, I might say I was going to get the fucking fella, talk to me mates and get him bashed up outside.
Yeah.
And then, for instance, they might go, well, most of the regular cons would have gone, yeah, fucking do him. But, you know, this guy, the one I'm talking about, he went, no, that's, you know, he's done nothing wrong. He doesn't know, you know. So then we were having this discussion.
Yeah.
And then after a little while, I go, oh, thanks for that. No, I appreciate that. Shook his hand. Now I go, well, you won't tell anyone, will you? He goes, no, I won't tell anyone. He fucks off. Next day, I say to him, you were right. I've done that. I've done what you said. You know, thanks for that. I really appreciate it. Then he come back and he go, do you mind if I tell you something? And I go on. So he'd be sitting on me, or on the guest chair, which was the toilet. Yeah. You know, he'd be sitting there and he'd go, look, can I tell you something? And then he'd tell me what's on his fucking shoulders.
But you'd basically just, by saying, oh, don't tell anyone, you're showing them that they're safe.
I was just winging it at the time. But like, when you look back at it, that's exactly what I was doing.
Yeah, so like you kind of offer a bit of yourself to say like, oh, look, I get like that.
Mm.
And then by then saying, yeah, don't tell anyone, it's like then they will trust you because they've got something on you. And then,
yeah,
and vice versa. That's amazing.
And I was telling someone else this just a little while ago.
Yeah, really good.
That I was walking to Liverpool Street from an art gallery called Jealous. And I was walking down to Liverpool Street. And it's only about, I don't know, 400 or 500 yards. And as I'm walking along, I've heard, Gary, is that you? I've looked over and I went, all right, mate. And I thought, well, he ain't the arty type, because all my friends are artists now, you know. I thought, well, he looks like he's someone from my old, he was going, Gary, Mansour. And I thought, fucking hell, don't say it's Ag or, you know, someone I've had over in the past. Yeah. He's come running over and his eyes were glazed as he come to me, right? And I saw it, I thought this might be where it's a bit windy, he's running across the road or whatever. And he's fucking shaking me by the hand, but with both hands, you know, like a desperate sort of shake. And he just went, fucking thank you. And he went, do you remember me from Swellside? Like the cranky gel. I went, oh, fucking hell, yeah. I said, I didn't at first, how are you? You know, he might have gone, oh, I'm fucking Colin or something.
Yeah.
Oh, fucking hell, Carl, yeah, sorry, I didn't recognise you. He went, I fucking wouldn't be here if it weren't for you. He said, I didn't want to say anything. He said, but you sat me down once. He said, we had a chat. And fucking hell, I started getting welled up because I was like, I can't, and that's the thing, I can't remember him. So I feel quite bad. And the amount of times I've tried to figure out who he was.
Well, the thing is, you've already done the good thing. You know, it doesn't matter that you can't remember him, really, because you've done
Yeah, amazing. I agree.
And I almost think, I was talking about this the other day with someone about how you kind of turn the bad shit into good shit. You know, like you'd learned something along the way and you starting to turn it into something positive.
Yeah.
Even in that fucking horrible situation, you then started to turn it around. Not everyone does that. And that's the thing, not everyone does. It takes a certain type of person to actually fucking do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's massive credit to you. Like, I think
you
be aware and pat yourself on the back when shit like that happens.
Yeah.
So what? So you sent out all the things. I'm just wary of time.
Oh, cool.
You sent out all those things. Was one of them the Lord?
Yeah, the one who died. He died last week.
Yeah, I know. I read that your post about it. I messaged you because it was like, what a lovely, lovely story. You know, what a lovely thing. What a lovely, lovely man.
Well, if I just go from where I left off, I've sent out 32 letters and I've got 28 back from all of those artists. And they were sending me books, catalogues. And I didn't realise at the time, but the people that wrote back to me are now world-renowned. You know, they are among the best artists in the world. And they was writing to me and they guided me through my sentence towards a degree.
Really?
And I've worked with them since. I've met them, you know, obviously I've met them since upon release. When I was at uni, I'd go to their like after show parties and that sort of thing. Then I'd work with them as an artist since I've been out. And I was on the phone to one of them yesterday for about 40 minutes, just having a little quarantine chat, as you do. But the person you're talking about was Lord Bath. He was well-renowned for being a very, what we would call, a cranky type of person, you know. He was very eccentric.
That's it.
He had several wifelets, he used to call them.
Yeah.
He was an artist as potty as a box of frogs. And when I got released, he invited me up to... he used to own Longley.
That's how I knew him.
Yeah. So he had offices in London. He invited me up to the offices, invited me to Longley. He was potty, but he was just such... It doesn't matter what he was. He, like all those other artists, he wrote to a bloke in prison who fucking put his hand out for help. Yeah. And I could have been a crazy ass murdering rapist for all they knew, but they looked at me just as someone who wanted some help with art, and I appreciated it, and I still do to this day, how they can't even imagine, you know. And I didn't see this Lord Bath. He used to do these make these Christmas cards every year, and he'd always send me a Christmas card even if I hadn't spoke to him throughout that year. And then I heard just a couple of weeks ago that he died because of the coronavirus. Yeah. And it really fucking saddened me, you know, that more than it should have done, really. Maybe because he's one of those who sort of helped, you know.
I'm not surprised it saddened you, man. It saddened me to read it. It's like someone actually gave you a chance, you know, like, and so often people don't, do they?
Yeah. And I don't often on social media, I mean, as much as I'll always post other people's stuff for Instagram.
Oh, yeah,
but I never normally, if you look through my posts, I don't normally give too much of me away, if you know what I mean. In my art, I will. But yeah. Very rarely put any talk about personal stuff on there.
Yeah.
And that was one of the very few times when I've just gone, well, you know, if fucking people deserve to hear what this, you know, aristocrat, because people see him as being a sort of sexist because he had several of these wives. He was very hedonistic and, you know.
I just saw him as being, well, I don't know. Like, I don't like sexism, but, like, I like people who do things their own way.
Yeah. I mean, I had lots of people, when I mentioned him at uni and that sort of thing, I go, oh, I don't like him because of this. And I say, look, I don't care whether any... I didn't say it like this because it sounds quite patronising. But in my mind, I was like, I don't give a fuck what anyone says about him.
Yeah.
He helped me when I needed it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and even if it would have been something bad he would have done, I would have said, yeah, he's an arsehole for doing that, but he helped me once. That was it.
So where, so when you were, so you were doing art inside, did you do any, like, art qualifications whilst you were inside?
Yeah, GMVQ. I started on a level two, which was like the intermediate.
Yeah.
I'd done that at Swaleside, and then I got told I could go to another one, another prison, a category C, because I'd done that GMVQ. That enabled me to have my categorisation lowered.
Yeah.
And then I went to another jail, and it turns out they said that I can go to this other jail and go to college. When I got there, that weren't even an option. And the tutor at that jail was less qualified than the one I just left, and she wasn't able to teach me the grade three, like the advanced.
Oh, really?
So I contacted Dougie in the other jail, and he sent me through the guide that the tutors have, like this great big fucking thick thing.
Yeah.
And I had to, it was all how it was from the governing body, and it's a you know, it tells the tutors how to teach the lessons and what category and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So he sent that to me. So I've ended up teaching myself the advanced one because of these guidelines that he'd sent me.
Yeah.
So when I did go to the next jail, when I was allowed out to college, I went there and the tutor said, you know, like, show me the work you've done, for instance. And I just got my portfolio out and I had it all in order of this book that he'd sent me.
Yeah.
And she's got her own book, which is a copy of mine.
Yeah.
And she's going, oh my God, you know, she's like, she'd seen fuck all like it, you know.
Yeah.
So I've just done it myself. She finished it off, which enabled me then to apply to university.
So did you go, so you applied for university, did you have to wait till you got out to go there?
I could have done it about 9 months before, but I wanted to get, I was allowed to go out and get a job, like on a building site or whatever. So I figured I'd be best off giving myself a year to, or a few months to go to work to try and get a few quid in the bank.
Yeah.
And at this point, I still had a few doors, as in clubs,
yeah,
on the go. Like when I went away, we had fucking 20-odd clubs. When I come out, I had like two. But I was still getting a bit off the doorman, so I had a little bit of money there. But I thought I'd be better off getting a job, banging all that money away, so when I do start university, I'm not going to be in a position where I might go, oh, fuck it, I'll go and do a little bit of skullduggery to get a few quid, which puts me back on that route again.
It's so, like, but you know what? So many people don't stop and think about it. You know, so many people...
No, but they're, because most people haven't got a fucking reason not to want to.
Yeah.
I did. You know, I had this family of artists that were a substitute to my family of criminals, because everyone I knew before was a criminal.
Yeah.
And if they weren't a criminal, they was okay with crime. Yeah. You know, like most, you know, most of the people, you know, in the block of flats I lived, they weren't criminals, but if you got hold of any dodgy meat, they'll buy it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the sort of thing I mean.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden I had this shift of a community, if you like.
Yeah.
And then my interest got, you know, absorbed into these people.
And it so, really helps, didn't it? It backs up if you're like really chasing art. Like I found, like just chatting, like knowing you, has really kind of backed me up as an artist, because like you've got someone else to talk art about. It helps to be around other artists. And
people like us, Nick, if you don't mind me saying, we stereotypically, we shouldn't be part of that art world. We should be a tattooist or a sign writer. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They don't mind that. They don't mind people like, as soon as we crossed the threshold into a bit of fine art, I mean, I saw it straight away with, and I still get it now, you know, years and years down the line. People sort of look, when I start talking about art, they think, oh, fucking Chancer, or, you know.
It's funny, isn't it? Because if you think like Damien Hirst, Northerner, isn't he?
Yeah.
He hasn't got any...
Working class family, single parent.
Yeah, Tracy Emin. Like,
same again.
And if you think, what were they around, like, 80s? They were, like, yeah.
Yeah, but people will excuse the... When they're famous, that's different then, because most people think that these famous people have always been famous. You know, when we look at Ronnie Wood, for instance, that's a rock star. He's always been a rock star.
Yeah.
You know, he fucking weren't, you know, not until his early 20s,
true,
you know.
True. So then what happened then? So the, where did you go to university?
University of East London.
Yeah, I didn't know.
And at the time, Goldsmiths was the thing, because that's where Damien Hirst and all that come from. Right, so I purposely, I had, you have a list of three, and you have to put them in order.
Yeah.
I had University of East London first, then Goldsmiths, and then it was Byam Shaw, which has gone there. It's part of University of North London or something like that. But Byam Shaw was like a drawing school and prestigious, as was Goldsmiths. University of East London is an old, what they used to call a polytechnic. And when I went there, even the tutor said, why have you got University of East London first? And I said, I had it in my head that I was going to be a famous artist because I had that drive, I had that passion. And on top of all that, I was working my bollocks off and I fucking loved it, right? Obsessed with it.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I'm going to be famous, but I don't want Byam Shaw or Goldsmiths taking the credit for it. I didn't want to go, oh, yeah, thanks to Goldsmiths.
Really?
Yeah, that was how I had it in my head.
Fucking hell.
And when I told the tutors, like, who was doing the interview, one of them was like nodding, he's pulled someone else out, he's going, have a look at his portfolio, just tell him why you want to come to University of East London. And yeah, that was it. And it, yeah, I got in. It was fucking brilliant.
So you did 3 years.
Hmm.
God, I wish I do. I do sometimes wish I'd have finished my degree. I still kind of talk to a few people who did finish it. And I don't, very, very, like, maybe one or two still does artwork.
Well, Grayson Perry opened our third year show, so that was pretty cool.
Have you been up to his house, the Julia house?
No. Oh, no.
It's fucking amazing.
Is it?
It's just like nothing else. And it's like on like a hill. There's like houses here, but like, when you look at it, like the aspect of it is, there's like, you can see the river in the background.
Yeah.
It's just got these really rich greens and yellows and bits of red. And it's pretty breathtaking.
It's good,
like, I didn't think I'd be bothered. And then I went there and I felt a bit choked looking at it.
Good.
And like, I really did. And like, that's the beauty of art, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you said it was like, you, when we were talking earlier, you said like a bit later on, like, so when you came out, I keep saying you came out. you're like me, we don't care. but like you said that you had a dip afterwards, like kind of
in my second year. Well, the thing was, although I'd had a different mindset when I was in jail, I no longer saw myself as a criminal, right?
Yeah.
I'd said from doing that grade 2 GMVQ, I had it in my head that if I try the hardest I can, probably 100%, if I don't get the top grade, then I'm not good enough. If I get the top grade, I'm going to go forward. So I set myself a little goal, right?
Get yourself up.
Yeah, either way.
Really hard to get a first.
This was for the GMVQ, not for the. So it turns out, I'm not big-headed often, but when the guy turned up, he said, this is the best I've ever seen at this grade. And I'd work everywhere through the education department. Normally, the art class would be divided up into two for two students. I had the art class, the education lower, the education upper, I had the stairs,
right.
I had it everywhere. And the tutor said, this is advanced level, all of it. Not, you know, there's nothing that wouldn't be advanced level. He said, and that project's going up the stairs, because it was all these different paintings.
Yeah.
He said, that's university level. And then that was the absolute catalyst when I changed, because even walking back to my cell from that afternoon, my shoulders were back. I've always been a fat fucker, but I felt like fucking freestone lighter.
I'm good enough.
Yeah.
I'm fucking good.
That's it, I've changed. And I was changed that day.
I've still got the letter that I got when I got into art, like university, and there was nothing like it. Like, I knew I'd smash the interview, but actually getting that letter and like, I'm good enough to go to university. Like, no one I knew had gone to university.
Yeah.
I was like, the first one amongst us all.
Yeah. But even though I was in a Category D prison where I was allowed out every day, I started university 2 weeks before I was released.
Did you?
And I went from a testosterone, violent, hard environment, straight into, with no break, I just merged straight into this liberal, friendly, hedonistic,
primarily middle class.
Yeah. And I should have had, that's where I should have had my year out. To, I never had time to enjoy the freedom, my freedom, you know.
Yeah.
I went straight from being prisoner to artist, bang. Back to back.
A lot older as well than most of the others.
Yeah, there was a few older ones there. There was probably, in a class of about 30, I'd say 10 of them were over 30.
Oh, that's not bad.
But, yeah, the first year, I was like a dog with two cocks. And I was just like, fucking everything.
Amazing.
Women, yeah. And the thing is, the male-female thing had changed in my 7 years away.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, although I've always had girl friends that were girls, loads of them, you know, all the time. But now it was a different, because like, even when we used to go out, it used to be all the blokes and then all the girls. Then we'd meet up later on and it wasn't like that anymore. Friends were just friends, male or female.
It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, but it was hard to get my head around because I just walked straight into that.
Yeah.
And another thing that fucked me up, going off piece just a little bit, is when I come out, people had mobile phones, weren't a thing when I went away. When I come out, people were talking on these headsets that was just like a fucking earpiece with a little mic next to it.
Everyone's taking the piss.
No, I thought I'd fucking police following me everywhere. Fucking paranoid as you like. But yeah, going from one institution straight into another, and they were polar opposites, I found that quite hard. But for a year, I was just going to these exhibitions, meeting these now world famous artists, and they're talking to me on a level, you know. And I'm taking the students with me to these big fucking after parties.
And you must have been the man if you were like in an art.
It felt like it.
Yeah, I know them.
And what was a good one when the person who ran the masters, the MAs, he came to me because we was having visiting artists. He came to me and he'd won the Turner Prize, right? This Grenville Davy. And he came to me and he went, oh, what was the artist? He went, oh, do you know so-and-so? Because he'd gone round about all the artists I knew. He said, do you know so-and-so? Cornelia Parker. And I went, yeah. He went, would you be able to get hold of her and trying to get her to give a talk? And I went, yeah, sure. And I didn't see anything of it. And my mate Lee, who I'm still best friends with now, he went, fucking hell, you've just had a Turner Prize winning artist ask you if you can have a fucking, if you can get in touch with an artist for him, you know. And that's when I realised.
Your world just gone whoosh.
Yeah, upside down.
Your world just totally, totally changed.
Yeah.
That must have fucking been a bit hard to take at points. That is pretty amazing though, Gary. It really is.
It wasn't until the end of the first year, and then universities are shut for like 3 months. And I was still going into my university studio every day for that 3 months. There was me and like this Lee I'm talking about. Lee would go in about 3 times a week. I was going in 7 days a week.
So were you still, like living there then?
No. So you was living just down the road in Romford.
Oh, okay, right, yeah.
But then, yeah, I sort of, as if I had like a little burnout or a breakdown, or I don't know what it was, but either way, it weren't a good thing. And I had a few things go on at the time. My granddad died. I was trying to resuscitate him, you know, that sort of thing. Fucked me up. Yeah. Took me so bad. I tried I didn't try to do it myself. That was an exaggeration. But I was looking at ways which would be the best way for me to do it. I got to that point. Where I was going, right, I don't want to do myself like my wrists staying me. And then I found the one that I was going to do. So I was just, I've got myself to that point.
This is something I was thinking about today, is that quite often when you might, from the outside, you're looking in and someone seems to be so much on the up, you know, it's like, you know the artist is doing really well, your work's coming out great, and like you've got this whole future ahead of you and you've pushed this other life away and you're doing so well.
Yeah.
And like, it's really hard for people to see that within that, you might be fucking in your head thinking, I want to die.
Yeah.
Like, people really often struggle to see that in me because I just don't really come across that way.
Mm.
But I'm like, I wear a lot of black. it's in there. It can happen.
Yeah.
So how did you get out? So what did you do? How did you pull out of it?
It's one of those, I'm not a spiritual person, right?
But I tell you what, nor am I though, mate, but I do, like, I learned that there's more going on, because it's those kind of things that get me through.
Right, well, my granddad died, he just passed away, but I happened to be there, and it was like 1 o'clock in the morning. My nan had phoned me up, asked me to go around to help move him, because he'd got himself in a funny position. She couldn't move him, you know.
Yeah.
So I've moved him. She thought he weren't breathing, so I'm trying to resuscitate. Never had a clue about resuscitation, right? So I'm trying. And just before he died, when I moved him, he was still alive then, obviously. When I moved him, he went to me, he looked at me and he went, "You're a good boy." Right? So it was the last words he ever said, "You're a good boy," right? So no matter what happens, I'm a good boy in my head, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I tried to resuscitate him, it wouldn't happen. Ambulance service come up, they've done the adrenaline in the heart, they said he's gone. And then I've always been ashamed of this, but I put it on the fucking ambulance driver or the paramedic, and I went like, "You fucking go down them stairs, you work on him in front of my..." Because by this time my aunts were there, my uncles were there, you know.
You were running on fucking...
Either way, it was wrong.
Yeah, but you know, you didn't know it at the time.
I said, "Don't you let them know that he's dead. You know, they're going to find out." But anyway, from that, like, as I said, my dad weren't about when I was a kid. My granddad was my father figure.
Yeah.
But by this time, I was with my other half, who I'm still with now. And like, we'd stay together from that night. I was up all of that night. But from the next night, I went to bed. I was having these horrific nightmares, not just scary, they was horrific. It would start with me being at his funeral. This was before he died. Me being at his funeral, the curtains close, and then the fire starts. I run through the curtain, open the door, and I'm trying to pull the coffin out. The coffin lid's open. My granddad's looking out, half a face, all burned.
That's a response to trauma.
Of course, yeah. At the top, but this was every this was every night.
Oh, fucking
not like, but for about 3 months, every single night. And after, it would get progressive, it'd be more.
Yeah.
I'd open up and he'd be holding his hand out, and I'll be trying to get his hand, but there'd be flames and stuff. And then he'd be calling me, Gary, help, help. And then it was just getting worse. And honestly, I mean, my wife's in the other room. She'd be able to back me up on this. Got to the point, it was so horrific, I would be vomiting in my sleep.
Where it's, I'd
wake up and I'm reaching. Where it's, what I'm seeing is so, I'm not even going to go beyond what I saw. And I'd get up in the night, and I'd be running, puking as I'm running to the bathroom. And I couldn't take that anymore. This is the night it changed, right? My nan went, I can't remember whether she went on like this little, I've got an uncle who's got a few quid. He treated my nan to a holiday, right? So my nan asked if me and Jenny, my other half, would stay around, because we didn't have our own place, but we were together. She was pregnant at the time. Would we stay around and look after the house? Now, we were sleeping in the bed that I was fucking resuscitating my granddad in, right? So I'm thinking, and I'm still having these dreams. And it's weird, but in the dreams, my wife knew when I was having the terrors, because she said I'd be laying on my side, and it's as if I was cycling my feet, going round like that, you know? I don't know, fuck knows what that means. But we was in my nan's bed, and I'm late. I'll get a little bit upset there. Sorry. We land in my nan's bed and I'm asleep and the terrors have started again, right? The same thing. I've gone running. I was like running through. I was at his funeral, running through the people, like, you know, cutting through, trying to push them out of the way to get to the curtains. So it was about to start again. So I knew what was about to happen. But I've opened the curtains, and then I'm in. There was a film I saw when I was a kid, and it was to do with, I think it was Palm Sunday, when like the slaves were holding, I don't know, a nobleman up on the, no, where they have them on the chair. Yeah. So I've opened the curtains, expecting the horror to start, and then my granddad's up on his phone, being held by these people, and they're walking along. And oh, sorry, I'm getting a little bit upset.
Oh,
I'm getting a bit upset. But he was waving at me.
Saying it's all right.
Yeah, he's going, you're all right. Oh, sorry about this.
Wow, Gary! That's one of the most amazing things I've ever heard.
Yeah, but it's as if he was going up in the air as well. I don't know whether the people were holding, but he was looking behind this chair and waving at me.
It's all right.
Never had him after that.
Gary, I've got, like, 5 minutes. And I just don't think I've ever had a better guest.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, this is the odd man, look, sitting here in fucking chairs.
No, but I just think he's so lovely.
Yeah.
Like, what an amazing thing. And it's just, you know what, when my grandpa died, I think my sister was waiting for something like that to happen to her. Mm. And I think she's always been quite upset that it never did. And it's so lovely that happened for you.
Yeah, shit happens, don't it, eh?
What an amazing fucking story. Gary, you've blown me away on so many levels tonight.
There you go.
You really have. I'm really proud to know you.
Oh, thank you, mate.
You've done some amazing things that just, no matter what's happened, like, you've just got this fucking massive heart.
Oh, thank you. I've got massive fucking everything. Look at the size of me.
It's just talking about like being in prison and that, and then actually the turning things around and like caring about people.
Life's good now. I'm an artist.
The environment is really nice, but in the worst fucking environments, you've managed to be kind.
Most people aren't. Pays off. It pays off.
I'd like to do it again. I feel like I want to go. I feel like I'd like to do an episode where we go university onwards. Because I feel like we could have probably done another hour.
I do rub it on a bit. I do apologise.
No, not at all. I have enjoyed every single fucking minute of it.
Yeah.
I really have. You've been absolutely amazing.
Good on you.
And I wouldn't just say it. I'm not that kind of person.
No, thank you, mate.
I've loved it, Gary. You're a fucking blind.
Good.
You really are.
Good.
I really hate leaving it there.
You're quite all right.
But I'm going to have to.
You're lucky to get the granddad story. Very, very few people get that, even in person.
I know, but it's fucking amazing.
There you go.
Like, life-affirming, you know, a story that makes you think, I'm going to fucking keep going. You know, yeah. It's one of those stories that make you think, fuck it,
I always say it's been an uphill struggle, but I seem to be plateauing out now.
Well, yeah, I feel exactly the same, actually.
Good.
Like, now I feel like my life's starting to become good.
It's good to talk. That's Bob Hoskins. It's good to talk.
Right.
It helps.
Thank you so much, Gary. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, mate. Anytime.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.